We're going to introduce you now to Roberto Bernardo, also known as Bert on the Predator Hackers list. Roberto is a researcher at IBM who has been working on a project called USERP.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for hanging in there on this final stretch. I know I've been at this for a while, but hopefully I'll make it worth your while here. So this is a project I've been working on for a while now, probably almost 20 months. So it's somewhat mature at this point. And I sort of retitled the talk to Making the Web Peer-to-Peer. So let me explain a little bit what I mean by that. So peer-to-peer is one of these really loaded terms that, you know, people use for just about anything and everything. What I mean by making the web peer-to-peer is the idea of making everyone a publisher. So right now the web is very client-server in that there's a lot of people who browse the web and download content off the web, but most of those people never actually put anything on the web for others to download. So USERP is a project about changing that ratio, trying to make, you know, maybe not everyone a publisher, but anyone who wants to be a publisher should very easily be able to do it. Furthermore, easily be able to do it using their own hardware and their own resources. And this applies not only to corporate intranets, where we currently have the main USERP deployment, but also to the internet at large. And so the question is, why should we leverage the web for peer-to-peer? The main reason is simply that the web browser is ubiquitous. If you look at other peer-to-peer systems that have special-purpose clients, they've had important reasons that have driven the adoption of those clients, namely free music, right? I'm trying to do a peer-to-peer system in a corporate environment where I can't have those sorts of benefits of adopting our system. So immediately we decided we'd design it around, again, complete web browser compatibility. And furthermore, if you look at the protocols for the web, they're really, you know, not perfectly designed for peer-to-peer computing, but they have some aspects that can be used for peer-to-peer computing. For example, DNS, which you use to resolve machines in the web, is inadequate, even though not perfectly decentralized means for peer addressing. HTTP is an adequate communication mechanism for peer-to-peer communication. In fact, many peer-to-peer systems simply adopt HTTP because of its firewall friendliness. Okay, so this raises the question, why don't we just have everyone run their own web server and go home? We're done. Well, clearly that's a rhetorical question. There's several reasons why that's not a very good solution to building a peer-to-peer system. One of the most important that we identified was that it's just too hard. I mean, probably everyone in this room has no problem setting up Apache and MonSSL and, you know, whatever else you need to do to install, to have a fairly secure, robust environment. However, the ordinary user is used to one-click install of Napster or Kazaa. In comparison, you know, it's just not at all something people want to do. Furthermore, lack of search. So a lot of people define peer-to-peer computing by the ability to do dynamic content searches. Clearly can't do that if you have a website that is going up and down all the time. You could say, okay, well, Google, you know, eventually it'll index my site and people will be able to search that way. Not really true. It relies on crawlers. If you have transient availability, which most people do if they're running this on their personal machines, you know, crawler might come by, well, crawler might go down. Even worse, it might get indexed, but when someone comes to do the search, your machine might be down. They click on the link, it's broken. Not a very satisfying experience. A third and, again, extremely important reason why this is a bad idea is web servers just quite often don't work. If you're running one in this room, for example, no one in the outside world can get to it because we're behind this network address translator. There's other reasons as well, firewalls, dynamic IP assignment, etc. And I've already hinted at this, but poor availability. You turn off your machine, your content is gone. Well, we have these other peer-to-peer networks, such as Freenet, where you publish something and it stays there much longer than the availability of your machine. That's a nice feature and something we'd probably like to do if we could. Again, I do this in a corporate environment, but I think this actually applies outside the corporate environment as well. I think there's much more private and semi-private information that people are interested in sharing than there is public information. So a lot of peer-to-peer systems is focused on, okay, I'm going to publish files that I want to share with everyone. Well, I think just as interesting is the ability to selectively share content with other users. Now, what if we want to do this in the world where everyone's running their web server? Okay, I need an account on your web server, I need an account on your web server, and so on. So quickly, I needed to make sure I have different passwords on every machine in case one of these owners is malicious and will try to impersonate me elsewhere. You know, multiplies this by 10 or 100, and it quickly becomes a very impractical means for sharing. So these are the problems that USERP is trying to address. We provide an easy-to-use and, importantly, a cooperative web server that tries to solve much of these problems. What I mean by cooperative is your web server is not just talking by browsers to browsers that come to visit your site. Your web server is actually talking to all the other web servers that are involved in the network to achieve some of these features. So what kinds of things does it do? Well, if you run UServe on your machine, your website is exposed even if you're behind a NAT or a firewall. And hopefully if the network is reliable enough, we'll try to demonstrate that from here. Automatically provides uniform DNS addressing. So when I run UServe, no matter what machine or where I'm running it from, or in fact, even if my site is down, my site is always available at the URL bayardo.userve.ibm.com on the intranet. I'll give you some intranet URLs in a moment as well. Automatically supports fresh, complete content searches, even in the event of node transients. Very fresh results from this mechanism. Again, exploiting peer-to-peer methods. Importantly, automatically supports secure content access. Namely, we have our own integrated certificate authority. You just log in. You have SSL support immediately. But more importantly, you only need one user ID and password per user. So I can use one user ID and password to access secure content on any other node in the system, even if I don't trust that node. There's no chance that person is going to stash my password and impersonate me elsewhere. So I'll be demonstrating that as well. What about dynamic content? So I think it's important to note that UServe is not for running an enterprise class, you know, million hits a day website. Again, we're really sort of targeting the idea of personal web content sharing. Not just web content, but, you know, music files, pictures, and so on. But still some people will want to do dynamic content. If you say, okay, go write a few CGIs, well, they're likely to, you know, create a huge security hole and their machine will be taken over by viruses. So we try to address that by providing a simple yet secure mechanism for extending the features of your site. We call that the plugin infrastructure, and if I have time, I'll just quickly highlight that as well. And another very nice feature is the availability of your site can transcend the availability of your machine. Before I jump into the demo, let me quickly overview some design criteria. As I mentioned, I want everything to work through a web browser. So this really lowers the bar to entry in the system. I have some files I want to share with you. Even if you're not actually running any UServe-related software, I can give you a URL, you can get to it. You don't need to install any plugins, special clients, etc. But isn't this limiting? And to be honest, yes it is. There's only so much you can do with web protocols. For example, you know, we'd really like to be able to do multi-source downloads in our system. However, using web-compatible protocols alone, you really have to jump through hoops to get that to work. So we don't do things like that right now, but we do a lot of other interesting things. And interestingly, there's things such as the Open Content Network that are actually looking at extending web protocols to handle these sorts of things. So though it's not implemented in UServe right now, these sorts of initiatives are very complementary to what we're doing. Okay, how about the architecture? I mentioned it's a peer-to-peer system. It's not a purely decentralized peer-to-peer system. As I mentioned, we're using DNS for peer addressing. That sort of right off the bat implies we're going to be using at least some sort of centralization. So, you know, we sort of decided we're going to do that anyway. Let's take advantage of the centralization to handle other difficult to decentralize tasks. However, with the restriction that we want them to be lightweight. Why do we want them to be lightweight? Well, you know, I'm basically a one-person project right now. I want to be able to run it myself. I want to be able to do it on a minimal hardware. And that's actually a nice attribute for other institutions as well. So we will have some centralized requirements. However, we're going to keep them as light as possible. The fact is no content that users share is ever stored on a central server. It's always served directly from the end-user machines. The peers do all what I call the heavy lifting, compute and bandwidth intensive tasks. The central server does only the very lightweight things such as peer addressing, authentication, which is very hard to do decentralized, and things such as presence detection. Though in fact, actually the peers in the system cooperate to actually maintain a very consistent view of what sites are up and what sites are down. So it's not entirely centralized, that aspect of it. CodeCon, what about the code? It is not yet an open source system. However, we are involved in the process in IBM to open source it. Fairly far along. However, you know, it's the first time I've done this, so I don't know exactly how long it's going to take or what the outcome will be, but I'm pretty optimistic. We've had very good feedback so far. And IBM has a pretty good track record with open sourcing technology, so keeping my fingers crossed that it'll happen in this case. The code itself is almost all Java. We've tested it to work under Win32, Linux AIX, BSD, both the centralized components as well as the client components. The fact is I think it'll run on pretty much anything with a 1.3 Java runtime. We haven't really had any difficulties trying out new platforms whatsoever. Performance is quite good. Clearly it's not going to perform as well as a tuned Apache implementation. However, for the purposes you're using for, you're probably not going to notice any difference. About 100K lines of code, so it's not a huge system, but it's not tiny either. What's nice, though, it's almost entirely self-contained. So, you know, you can download our code and you can get a system up and going pretty quickly. The only dependency we have right now is we use Bind for DNS. Nothing wrong with that. Bind is a great system. So, instead of ranting on here, I'm just going to go ahead and jump into the actual system, and hopefully the network will hold up and let me do this. Okay. Looks, well, not 100% stable, but if anyone's like running Kazaa or downloading movies right now, you know, hold off for a little while. Well, let's try this. So I've got two deployments of user right now, actually. There's one, as I mentioned, on the IBM corporate intranet, and there's another one that's running at CMU. However, the one at CMU has sort of been intentionally restricted to, for reasons I won't get into, nor have we been able to promote it. So right now the main user base is involved with the IBM deployment. So that's the one I want to demonstrate today. So will I be able to load this page? So I've been trying to set up a virtual tunnel into the IBM network, and it's been working all day except for right now, of course. Let's see. Okay, hopefully this will come back up. This is sort of like the main portal site that if you want to get started with a system, you go and visit. And like most other peer-to-peer systems, it allows you to download the software. Outside IBM, we also have a registration system. The version inside IBM, we sort of leverage the existing IBM ID system, so you don't really even have to register. All you need to do is download the software, and then you can immediately run it to get started. And I would like to demonstrate that, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to right now. Well, that looks happy. Somewhat happy. Well, let's try it. Okay. So, once you've downloaded it, basically a self-executing jar file, so we can just double-click it. And it's possible if I can't get the IBM version to work, I can at least demo part of it through CMU, so let's give it a shot. So, first thing it does pops up, asks you for your login ID and password. As I mentioned before, in IBM, this is a standard IBM intranet ID, so there's no registration required. Before it does anything, it's going to verify that password, because in userv, your URL identity, your domain identity, is based on your actual identity. So, for example, as I mentioned before, I'm bayardo.userv.ibm.com. So before it's going to set that up, and of course it's not going to set it up because I can't get through the network, it needs to verify that password. So that's going to keep on trying until this thing hopefully recovers. That's not loading either. Well, let's see if I can do this through CMU. So, I'm going to be running actually two instances of userv here. There we go. This one seems to be up and running. So what it's doing right now is it realizes that it's not able to accept connections on port 80 for whatever reason. So what it's done is it's actually gone and routed itself through another machine. It's probably much too hard to see the small print in the small window, but if you can manage to make it out, it actually tells you the username of the machine it's routing through. So because this is an internet deployment, you guys can actually go to this link if you just, probably asking you for a crash the network even more here. If you type in userv.com, it'll redirect you to the CMU deployment. You can get an immediate listing of who's online and using the system. And this account is test user 2, and there it is. And so anyone on the internet right now can come and access the web server I have running on this machine, even though we're behind this big nasty NAT that would prohibit something like Apache from working. There it goes. So when you first install the software, it looks very much like this the first time you visit your site. You know, I've taken the initiative to create one additional folder. The important thing to note is it creates these access control subfolders. And I'll get into that shortly, exactly how that works. What I want to do first, though, is let me go back to this site's online page here. Is if you look at the list of users that are online, it actually is not the list of users online, it's the list of sites that are online and available. In fact, some of them have this little asterisk here. What that means is that the site is available even though that person isn't actually up and running the software. So, for example, Spiros Papadimitriou, this is his site here. He's one of the guys that is helping me out with the CME deployment. Assuming I can open that page, you can see that you can view his files exactly as if he had been actually running the software. Now, how does that work? So, in USERVE, it doesn't happen automatically. I mean, there's lots of privacy issues and things that make this sort of a really complicated problem. Our solution was a fairly simple one, yet still fairly powerful one, and that is the ability to set up replicators. In USERVE, you can designate any other user who's willing to participate as a replicator or a mirror of your site. So I can list right here the username of this person, and he has to do the same to me, so it's a double opt-in process. Once you've entered these two usernames, the site's automatically synchronized. Everything I put in my shared space is automatically replicated to any of these other ones, any and all of these other ones that I've listed. So, should my machine go down, the present system automatically detects that, and the DNS entry will be updated so that my site will now be served from one of these other available machines. So, from the end user's perspective, who's just accessing content, it looks exactly the same. There's no difference. But technically what's going on is this DNS failover. So we use very short DNS time to lives, for example. And my favorite rant is, if you do anything with DNS, and cache DNS entries, respect the time to lives. Please. There's this horrendous bug in Mozilla which causes it to cache IP addresses forever, and it just drives me nuts. And luckily I'm not the only one that's being irritated by that, and it's, I think, scheduled to be fixed in the next version. But unfortunately, this sort of disregard of DNS time to live is really rampant out there. Internet Explorer does it as well, but luckily only for 15 minutes. But even 15 minutes of downtime is still pretty annoying. Luckily you can restart the browser to get around this, but these sorts of issues are the types of things we have to contend with. So hold on a second, let me see if I can get to the IBM one yet. Yes. Wonderful, okay, I'm in IBM now. So this is the IBM intranet deployment, and to prove that this is more than a 20-user system, so on the IBM intranet, there's almost, I guess, 200,000 people that have access to it, and so far we've gotten 5,500 or so to actually use our software. Now we don't go around forcing people to use it, we just sort of let the system run, and you can see there's sort of links on everyone's pages that point people to the download page and so on. And so by word of mouth and very virally, it's been spreading. And any given week we typically have around 1,500 people that are actively using it. At peak hours we have over 900 sites available at any one given instant. And if you actually click through the sites, it's pretty actively used. People share lots of stuff. You know, they mostly use USERVE for sharing very large files that they would never want to deal with a centralized server for. We're not by any means an approved IBM method of sharing, but they do tolerate us. So we haven't been authorized for like really, you know, serious work purposes, enterprise class availability requirements, you know, confidential documents and so on. But there's a lot of things. There's a lot of people do use it for at work, you know, that just don't have these critical requirements. And luckily IBM's been very cooperative and they let us get away with that. This is, as an interesting aside, does anyone know what this sort of dip is here in the access log? That's the Microsoft slammer worm taking out the IBM intranet. I thought that was cute. Okay, so I've talked about firewall traversal. I've talked about the ability to replicate your content across other machines for improved availability. What I want to talk about now is let me demonstrate the access control and security features. So now that I have intranet access, let me exit the CMU serve one and go back to IBM here. And hopefully this will start this time. Oh, actually, I have it running already. There it is. Okay. Oh, actually, it has established connection without me noticing. Go and visit my site. Yeah, unfortunately, I forgot to set up the replica too. Well, there's other sites at CMU you can try. In fact, if you click on the Bayardo link, that's actually accessing files on my desktop behind the IBM firewall, for demonstration purposes only, of course. So this is the site I'm running on this laptop on the IBM deployment, and anyone in the intranet can actually get to that to access files on this laptop right now. What you notice here on every directory listing page is the ability to sign in to access secured content. Furthermore, also, if I just directly click on one of these access controlled files, let's take a look what happens. Actually, I've got this link built into my protected files on my desktop machine at IBM. So my site link is bayardo.userv.ibm.com. Of course, here it goes. Come on. Yay. So I click on that bookmark to a protected part of my site, and what it is asking me now is to authenticate. Now, though it's hard to see, what it's done is that it's actually redirected me to this authentication server. So, again, the goal is not to provide any passwords directly to the end user nodes, because you don't know exactly what they're going to do with them. So instead, there's a designated, trusted, centralized server where everything is verified. You can see over SSL connections. I can provide this guy with my password, who presumably I trust, and what he's going to do is verify it. Once verified, he's going to redirect me back to the site I was trying to access with my authentication credentials, as you can see, encrypted in the URL. So this is standard sort of single sign-on sorts of thing. But it really works quite well even in the peer-to-peer realm. And you can see that even this page, even though it's hosted by one of the peer nodes, is automatically SSL activated. We do that by integrating a certificate authority. The first time you fire up userv, you initiate the certificate request process, it gets downloaded. Obviously, these certs aren't signed by the standard trusted authorities of your browser. However, you can install the userv root certificate into your browser, which prevents all those nasty browser warnings you might otherwise get, regardless of the site you access. Okay, so now that I've signed into one site, I can visit another userv site, and that's what I'm going to do with this bookmark right here. And, come on. There it goes. Apologize for the slowness. So now what it's saying is, okay, you've already entered your password, so the authentication server knows who I am. However, it's just making sure I'm willing to reveal my identity to this other machine, saying, okay, hey, look, you're going to another site. He wants to know your identity before he can determine access. Do you want to let him know who you are? So I say, yes, I do want to go. And there I am within the private folder of that other machine. And you can see right here that that guy knows who I am. If you actually look in the logs, then you print out the username in a very straightforward manner. And everything in userv is logged, not only to disk like it would be with Apache, but also through this very neat GUI mechanism, which is a sort of a fun way to monitor what's going on. So you can create access policies, you know. Again, you don't need to assign passwords ever. You just list the users that want to access your stuff. You can actually also list user groups. So we have a user group server in IBM that we've tapped into. So people on my team are called Q Team, so I can just list that. Things such as wildcards are supported. For instance, if someone inside IBM could get a codecon.org ID, this would allow anyone like that access into this folder. Alright, so that's the single sign-on aspect. And you'd really be surprised at how important that is to a lot of users within the corporate environment. But another neat feature of userv is the search facility. So you can see here on any directory listing page, we have this little search bar. And if you just click the icon without any search terms, it'll take you to a more interesting search form. It sort of tells you in a little more detail what's going on. It looks a lot like Google, right? But it's quite different. First of all, this search form is being hosted by, again, the peer node. There is no central server that I go to visit a search form. And it lets me search either all content on the userv network, or it lets me search specifically the machine that's hosting the form that I'm accessing at the time. So, you know, a lot of people in IBM work on DB2. You can run a search to see what everyone's sharing. So, important thing to note here, I search for DB2, I got some hits that don't have DB2 in the title. That's because, again, it's really modeled very closely after Google. Even though it is a peer-to-peer search mechanism, we index the content as well as the keywords in the file title. The second thing to note here is it was pretty fast, right? We're not doing blind query flooding. We have a method in which we aggregate basically what we call site summaries at the central node, very compact summaries that can be used to quickly refine the set of peers that actually have to be directly contacted. So these results are actually filed by directly contacting the peer that has the matching document and getting the results back. However, there's a previous step in which you actually contact the coordinator to consult this very fine-grained query index to narrow the space of peers which need to be addressed. And I don't know how many people here know. Who knows what a Bloom filter is? Yeah, okay. Good number of people know what it is. For those of you that don't, it's a very compact means for representing set membership. So in this case, the set is the list of keywords that can appear in a document, and you want to determine whether the keywords in your search term match anyone's documents, right? So everyone creates a Bloom filter, which is just a list of bits, so it can be very efficiently compressed and transmitted. The catch is with Bloom filters, it can generate false positives. The nice thing is it can't generate false negatives. In other words, it won't miss anything. It might make me query one or two additional peers that don't actually have any matching documents, but, you know, in the scheme of things, that's a pretty minimum penalty to pay. Okay, so that is U-Search. I think I've said everything I want to say about that. The last thing I wanted to demonstrate today, how am I doing? A few more minutes? Okay, I want to show one more thing. This is pretty cool. Go back to my directory listing here. You may or may not have caught. I mentioned dynamic content earlier, and that's what I want to talk about now. If you do have these sort of dynamic content modules installed on your site, you'll get this additional tab called Plugin Tab. And if I click on that, it'll bring me to a page which shows me basically all the modules that are installed on the site that can generate, you know, interesting applications or interesting dynamic content. So the idea here is, again, to develop an analog to a browser plugin. You should be able to plug in things that extend your site's capabilities just as easily as you extend your browser's capabilities, and just as securely as well. So a website plugin is like a browser plugin. It's a signed entity, which is actually more or less site-independent. So there's no complicated configuration to any of these things. Any configuration can be done entirely through the web. So I keep all my MP3s on my site, not so I can share them with the world, but that's so I can listen to them while I'm at home, I can listen to them while I'm at CodeCon maybe, or while I'm at work. So one of the things I created was an MP3 playlist generator. So the plugins have access to an interesting API which allows you to get all sorts of state from the web server itself. For example, what files are being shared at any given moment. So the MP3 playlist generator, for example, uses that method to compile a list of MP3s currently being shared on the site. You know, if I'm interested in listening to, say, jazz music, I can enter search terms, submit that, and this will generate a sub-playlist, randomly generated if there's a lot of things matching the query, and of course it's a .m3u file, so since all this stuff is web-compatible, it'll work with your standard web enabled music player. And because the network is very slow, it's buffering right now. But you can see there's the music playing actually. Surprisingly, it does work at CodeCon. How's it going? Am I done? Okay, that's the basic idea. Let me say one more thing here. This is what's known as a standalone plugin. But because of the uniformity of these systems, we sort of envision people developing plugins that sort of, again, cooperate across all the nodes. So it's still a little bit early in the design of the system, but sort of envision lots of interesting meta P2P applications that are developed on top of this. So, take questions.
By the way, everyone, the way you get this thing to make noise is you talk into it.
Sorry. This is really neat. I have three questions for you. Is there a waiting list when you're going to announce that it's open source, that we can put our email addresses on?
Yeah, please feel free to send me your email address. I mean, that's the main reason I wanted to come to CodeCon, because I know there's an eager set of developers here, and I really would love to have people interested in working on this contact me. So, Bayardo, in fact, I have one more slide, the additional resources page that I meant to leave up here. And that has the spelling of my last name, and just Google it and you'll find me.
Two more questions for you. How do you do that little mu character with pure Java in your Windows sys tray?
It's a GIF. I'm sorry. You're talking about the system tray. Yeah. So we actually do have some native code for Windows.
Okay.
And Spiros, the guy at CMU who I mentioned earlier, has actually developed a GNOME tray icon to mimic that functionality under Linux.
Okay.
So we don't have it nicely integrated now, but it can be done under Linux as well. But yes, that actually extracts the DXLL automatically from the jar file, and it'll run it if it happens to be Windows platform. Okay. So
my last question, is there any papers on the web or in any journals that describe your stuff?
Yeah. In fact, that's what this page is basically saying. We actually, as a research lab, we're sort of obliged to write these things up and publish them whenever possible. So we have an older paper that appeared in last year's WWW conference. So it's somewhat dated. It doesn't describe a lot of the features I described today. It doesn't describe the fact that we now have, you know, pretty strong security in the system. But it does give you a good overview of what's going on, the motivations, and so on. A couple newer ones, one on the U-Search paper. Did that with a guy at Stanford named Mayank Bawa. And another technical report on the plugin infrastructure, which provides pretty good details on the API he did as well, if you're interested in that kind of thing. No, actually, this one you'll want to Google for Bayardo, and it's on my homepage. Userv.com will bring you to the CMU deployment. There you can browse the FAQ. The FAQ has some other interesting information you might not find on the papers. So.
With the replication, what kind of integrity guarantees are there that if you have replicated your site to someone else, that what they are serving is actually what the original site had?
Could you repeat that? I didn't catch the last part.
What guarantees are there with site replication that what gets served by the person mirroring your site was actually...
Right. I mean, there's absolutely none. There's not a whole lot you can do unless you add an extra level of indirection. If you want to start adding hashes and stuff to guarantee integrity, that gets really messy, right? So that's why precisely why we decided for this double opt-in trust-based method. You know, chances are if enough people are using the system, you're going to know at least one person, probably a friend of yours that leaves their machine running 24/7, and, you know, you can trust that they're not going to mess with your content while it's sitting on their disk. You know, we could have obviously made it a little harder for them to do that. I mean, right now, we basically copy the files as is over to the site. You can conceivably, you know, encrypt them, but then, of course, the key has to somehow be embedded in the web server. You know, a clever enough hacker can always figure that out.
Hi. From the look of it doesn't seem that it's scalable. Like, what happens if the central server fails? And the second question is, how do you, when you verify a user using the central server, how does that verification, how is it authorized on a new server? Is there a key?
Okay, I didn't catch the last part of the second question.
So when a user logs into a protected directory, he's verified with his password on the central server.
Right.
How is that verification?
That's just standard SSL, public key, private key, kinds of things. So, again, every user client is pre-programmed with the certificate of the user coordinator, so it knows who it's talking to. We try to reuse, again, as much web technology as we could. Let's go to the first... What was the first question again? Sorry. What happens when the central server fails? Okay, so right now the way we have it, we've distributed the DNS and separated it from the coordinating service. The coordinating service fails... the sites that are up and running keep running. You know, as long as you can resolve the DNS entries, you're all good. And of course, DNS allows you to replicate the contents, replicate servers across multiple domains. We haven't done that. We just have one. We found that to be fine, but, you know, if we needed more reliability, we could do that. The coordinator fails, well, you know, you're kind of out of luck. You know, you're kind of need someone to authenticate users in order to set up the DNS mapping. So you'd obviously, in a real enterprise-class deployment of userv, you probably want to have some sort of redundancy in that. We don't have that now, but yeah, that's obviously a drawback of a centrally coordinated mechanism.
This question is on behalf of Luke Transport, who's upstairs in the balcony. Are the plugins replicated as well?
No, that's not implemented as of now. You know, it's theoretically possible to just copy the plugins to the rest of the site. The problem is plugins that maintain state, right? So I was really fascinated by the content versioning systems being discussed, because conceivably you could use that kind of technology if you actually wanted to have plugins being replicated along with the state, because you need some sort of conflict resolution mechanism, because even if your site does fail over to another machine, it may come right back up, and sometimes DNS again is out of sync because people miscache these entries, so you will have synchronization problems, and that's a very difficult problem, but it is one that would be nice to have solved.
This actually solves a bunch of really interesting and neat problems, but one problem I always wanted a system like this to solve is this flush dot effect.
Yeah, well, actually, if you read the plugin paper we wrote, you can actually write a plugin that will more or less solve that. It's pretty straightforward. In fact, we suggest two methods of doing that. One is this method of routing through a proxy. We don't have it implemented yet, but proxies could conceivably act as web caches. So now you don't web through one proxy, you route through multiple web proxies. You set up your DNS so that, you know, DNS will round robin across all of them, and you effectively have, you know, a dynamic web caching mechanism. There's another way to do that that we described in the plugin paper using a plugin mechanism. Again, it's coordinated through a DNS mechanism, as long as your DNS mechanism can withstand the slash dot effect, which, you know, I think most reasonable connections probably can, and I think the system as a whole will be able to do it as well. But this is all, you know, of course, me speculating. We haven't actually implemented that yet, but it seems quite plausible.
At the start of your talk, you said that one of your goals was to allow everyone to provide content. Are you doing anything to address the fact that most commercial ISPs for home use are deliberately prohibiting people from providing content?
Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunately not much we can do about that. I mean, if they do block port 80, the system will still work, again, through the tunneling mechanism. However, if your ISP finds out you're doing that, they might get very angry. You know, there's not much I can do. I mean, I use Speakeasy. They let me do whatever I want. I highly recommend them. I mean, I pay a lot more for my access, but, you know, unfortunately, pricey I pay, I guess. Pricey I pay. I'm really hoping that the broadband solution problems will be resolved. Unfortunately, it seems to be getting worse and worse instead of better at this point, but, we'll see.
More questions?
Another replication question. With the replication, is it a one-time only and you have to manually tell it to update if you update your site, or is that...
No. That's once you set up the username, it's all system handled by them. The system will monitor your site for changes. Typically within 2 minutes of the change, it'll be propagated. If you have a very large site like I do, you know, I think I share like 6 gig or something like that. Java happens to be very slow at crawling file systems, so you can actually control that interval in the system. So I think mine is like 20 minutes, but it all works pretty well.
Actually, this is related to my previous question. I used to stream all of my music off of my server at home to my server at work until I thought about it and realized I was constantly using, oh, maybe like 10% of our bandwidth at work, and felt bad. Could a system like this be used to set it up to automatically... Hello? Oh. To automatically replicate stuff that you happen to access so that you'd only get the song once, and then when it came along in the playbook again, that...
I suppose you could do that. I mean, right now, again, it blindly replicates everything that a site you set it up to do. It's not really based on access, but... You can certainly build that through the plugin infrastructure. There's nothing there that's going to prevent you from doing that if you wanted to add it on that, if you wanted to add on.
We have a few more minutes for questions here. Question. Can you discuss the computational requirements of your indexing scheme a little bit more?
Yeah, computational requirements of the infrastructure, is that what you said?
Indexing scheme.
Of the indexing scheme. Sure, be happy to. Every node in the system indexes its own content, generates a full inverted text index. Once the inverted index has been generated and updated, it'll compile a list of terms in that index. That list of terms will then be converted into the Bloom filter. So I think we use 64K-bit Bloom filters. We don't currently compress them, but we could if we needed to improve performance in the future. That Bloom filter gets sent to the coordinator only when it changes. So, you know, as long as your site doesn't change too much, there's not much bandwidth required at all. Once that goes to the coordinator, again, it sits there and it gets aggregated with everyone else's. After that, when queries come in, of course, they first get directed to the coordinator. The coordinator simply has to check the list of bits and then return a list of sites to the querier. Then it's up to the querying machine to actually go and individually probe everyone on that list. And assuming it gets through that entire list, you're pretty much guaranteed that the results are complete within a few minutes or so.
Okay. Well, I think we're done with that.